This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, nice to see you,
Good to see you, yes.
Big week for Mayo Clinic Radio.
It is. We have our own channel now on iHeartRadio.
Which means that you can listen to this on your phone, on
any device, iPad, on your computer.
Anywhere in the world.
And at any time of the day, 7 days a week. So if you go to iHeartRadio and you just type in Mayo Clinic Radio, you can get our 1 minute events, and we've got our whole programs there. You can listen to us 7 days a week if you want.
So if someone misses this show, they can go back and access it on iHeartRadio.
Or if they find something here they like and they want to share it with others, they can push it that way too.
What do you mean if they find something they like?
Well, maybe someone really has information about thyroid. We will give that information out, and people want to let others know.
I think everybody would want to know something about
the
thyroid. You know, that's that little gland that most of the time, many of us never even think about it. We don't even know where it is, or probably even that we have one. It's a small, but I know you know about yours.
I
because
sure do.
Yours has given you a little trouble, hasn't it?
It's made life interesting over the years, yes.
It's a small butterfly-shaped organ situated on the front of the neck, and it's up against the voice box and the windpipe. But it has lots of jobs to do. Some people say it controls metabolism. Really, it controls how fast our body uses energy. It makes proteins, and it helps control how sensitive our body is to other hormones that are produced in the body. And it does all this by producing a couple of hormones itself. Now, the main hormones that the thyroid produces are hard to pronounce, particularly for a bone doctor. So we often just call them T3 and T4.
I like that better, yes.
Yeah. Easier for us.
Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with one of the world's experts on the diseases of the thyroid, Dr. Ian Hay. Dr. Hay is a graduate of the University of Glasgow in Scotland. He completed his internal medicine and endocrinology training at Glasgow Royal Infirmary. Prior to coming to Mayo as a senior clinical fellow, he was awarded the first Randall G. Sprague Award for outstanding achievement as an endocrine trainee.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, and he's been a consultant in endocrinology and internal medicine at Mayo Clinic ever since. He's received multiple prestigious awards during his career, and he is joining us today. There's a lot of them here. Do you want me to go through them?
Well, I know you could go on and on and on, couldn't you?
Yeah, there are a lot of them.
I think maybe the one that he might be most proud of is that he is the Richard F. Emslander Professorship, Professor in Endocrinology Research, and that award was given to him by the Board of Trustees of the Mayo Foundation. Dr. Richard Emslander has had a wonderful career, a long career at the Mayo Clinic, and the left a professorship here, and Dr. Ian Hay was the recipient of that. But he's also co-author of a leading textbook of thyroid diseases and endocrine cancer. It's called Clinical Endocrine Oncology.
Very good.
Probably what you don't know, in addition to all of that, he is doctor to many of the big names on the professional golf tour.
Ah, that's why you think he's so interesting.
Yeah, that's right. He's got a lot of things going for him. So Dr. Hay today is going to discuss multiple different diseases of the thyroid, but we will concentrate on a couple of things that he is particularly interested in. One is thyroid nodules, which affect some 50% of the people around the world. And the second thing we'll talk about in particular is cancer of the thyroid gland. It's estimated that that may affect at least 10% of the people in the United States, and it is a cancer that is becoming more and more common. I don't think we really understand the reasons why, but particularly among women.
Well, all that will be coming up. But first, last week you may have heard about the new Surgeon General report that showed that smoking can cause diabetes, colorectal and liver cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, erectile dysfunction, impaired fertility and immune system weakness.
Is there anything good you can say about smoking?
No.
Probably not.
The report also concluded that secondhand smoking could cause strokes for non-smokers, too. That SG report was the health consequences of smoking 50 years in progress. So 50 years out, This is the report that they're releasing. And since the first report was published 50 years ago, more than 20 million Americans have died because of smoking. Joining us to discuss this report is the director of the Nicotine Dependence Center, Dr. Richard Hurt. Good morning, Dr. Hurt.
Good morning.
Hey, morning, Rich. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
So what do you think? After 50 years, there's a lot we've learned. And I think when the original report came out, it just suggested that there was a link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And we've learned a lot more since that and a lot of more bad things about smoking, right?
Well, the 64 report actually said there's a causal relationship between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And that was the first time that an official government agency had ever said that. So that really connected the two. And since then, over the last 50 years, that same connect the dots, if you will, has been done with multiple different diseases. And you're exactly right. There's very little benefit to smoking.
What's the significance now of this new Surgeon General's report?
Well, it just extends what we already have known. I mean, we take colorectal cancer, for example. We've known that smokers are at higher risk for having colon polyps. And we've known that for several years. And, of course, polyps are what lead into developing colon cancer. So there just now is enough evidence that linking not only the development of colon polyps, but the higher risk of colon cancer. So that wasn't a great big surprise. And so the point, I guess, to be made in all this is that cigarette smoking is the only thing you can, only product you can name. Cigarettes are the only product you can name that if left to the consumer to continue to smoke, will kill over 60% of the smokers. And that's the equivalent of almost 480,000 Americans dying every year from cigarette smoking. Even today, that's the equivalent of 3 fully loaded 747s crashing daily, 365 days a year, with no survivors. So though we've made progress, this is way not over. We have almost as many smokers today as we did 50 years ago. Over 40 million. So we just need to continue to be vigilant about this to make sure people understand that if you're going to continue to smoke, it's going to be bad news on the other end. And the other thing I'd say is that we now know, after the last 3 or 4 decades, that women have caught up with men. Mm. That they, and the conclusion of this article was, if you're going to smoke like a man, you're going to die like a man. So the incidence of lung cancer and COPD and all-cause mortality is identical in men smokers and women smokers.
Well, 50 years ago when that first Surgeon General's report came out, there were people looking around going, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And now, who would admit to saying, I didn't know that this was so deadly? I mean, we've gotten that message out, haven't we?
Well, the people that would say that now are Philip Morris, Reynolds American, Lorillard, Liggett, because in the state of Florida, they're still contending that these cigarettes don't cause addiction, much less all the diseases. So the people that are still spouting that are the people that are making the money from this, which are the cigarette manufacturers.
And in fact, nicotine is about as addicting as crack cocaine, isn't it?
Well, when it's delivered like in cigarettes. Now, the other thing that the Surgeon General's report said, I think either this time or 2 years ago, was that the more recent cigarettes deliver nicotine faster and in higher doses to the brain than they did just a decade or two ago. So these manufacturers are continuing to do that. So when it's delivered via the cigarette is the most elegant drug delivery device that's ever been invented. Hmm. And the cigarette manufacturers continue to perfect that. The secret of the Marlboro wasn't the cowboys and the theme from the Magnificent Seven. The secret of the Marlboro was adding ammonia to the tobacco to freebase the cocaine, to freebase the nicotine. So it's much like freebasing cocaine.
Hmm. Incredible. Now, what do you think about, I think I have heard you suggest in the past that maybe we ought to ban tobacco products in this country.
Well, if you think about it a second, what I said earlier, if we had 3 747s to crash tomorrow, does anyone listening think there'd be a 747 flying on Wednesday of next week? We would not tolerate that. Our government would not tolerate. We as a people would not tolerate that. We would say, ground them all until we fix the problem. And so at some point, we need to come to full grips with this. Now, there are countries like Singapore, Tasmania, New Zealand, Scotland, Ireland, Australia, who are moving toward a tobacco-free society within the foreseeable future.
Hmm.
Because cigarettes are not something my great-grandparents had to contend with. Cigarettes are a 20th century phenomenon. The year of the camel was 1913, so the 2013 was the 100th anniversary of the invention of the first modern cigarette, the camel. So this is a 20th century phenomenon carrying on into the 21st century. We lost 100 million souls worldwide in the 20th century. If we do nothing different, we will lose a billion people to tobacco-caused diseases in the 21st century.
Wow. Dr. Richard Herrick, camels, we called them humps back then, you know, when I was a kid. Yep, and the red balls, the Lucky Strikes, remember those?
And we should say that if people want help kicking the habit, they can come and see you at the Nicotine Dependence Center.
Or they can call the telephone quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, that's available in our state, and they can get free nicotine patches through that. The Salvation Army Free Clinic is available for people. We've trained some of our medical personnel there to help people to stop smoking, because there are multiple resources. There's an internet site called becomeanx.org. That's an excellent internet site that we have developed the clinical material for. So the Nicotine Dependence Center, Telephone Quit Line, Salvation Army Free Clinic, and becomeanx.org.
Thank you, Doctor.
Hey, good to talk to you, Doctor.
Right.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, bottom line there is if you're going to smoke, odds are it's going to get you.
Yeah, probably not a good choice.
Nope. Time for a short break. Well, coming up, we'll talk with endocrinologist and thyroid expert Dr. Ian Hay, plus this myth or matter of fact. Once you start thyroid medication, you have to stay on it forever.
Is that
myth or matter of fact?
Yeah, we'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Dr. Hay at 507-282-1234. Go to our website, radiomayoclinic.org, to leave a question or tweet us at any time. Hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae, along with today's guest, endocrinologist, Scotsman, doctor to the stars of the PGA Tour, and thyroid expert, Dr. Ian Hay. Dr. Hay, welcome. So good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
And this is Thyroid Awareness Month, so appropriate that you're here. So how did you get interested in the thyroid gland? And tell us a little bit about that gland, where it is and what it does.
Well, I was exposed in Scotland to a lot of smarter people than me who were very interested in the thyroid, and I thought it was the most exciting area as a medical student to get into. The thyroid gland, as you well said, if you looked yourself in the mirror, you would see it probably in a good day halfway between the Adam's apple and your little notch between the collarbones. And as the good man Shives has said, it's a butterfly-shaped thing. It's about 25 grams, usually in size, about 2 inches each lobe. It sits, as he said, around the windpipe, pretty close to the esophagus. But the nice thing about it is it's superficial. It's very easy to examine the thyroid as a doctor.
So you can, most of the time, tell if someone has, just on the exam, a normal thyroid versus an abnormal thyroid.
I think with experience, one can get very sensitive, although unfortunately we live in an era where the imaging is even more sensitive than the best doctors.
And isn't that part of the problem, or is that a problem, that the technology makes it easier for us to take a look at that and maybe blows some of these problems up?
Yes, I fear that thyroid doctors are getting ever more busy in the last 20 years because of our radiological colleagues using MRI, CAT scan, PET scans, and especially high-resolution ultrasound to find that half the population have abnormalities in the thyroid gland, structural.
Well, abnormalities aren't good, though. Correct?
Yes. Lumps and bumps worry people, and clearly the first thing to be said is that most nodules in the thyroid gland are benign. But it's sometimes a challenge to prove that, although I think things are getting much more straightforward.
So is that part of the reason why this is being diagnosed so much more now, is that we have more technology to be able to go and find these issues?
Indeed. I think, for example, in Korea, where I guess they're very disciplined and have a lot of important radiological manufacturers and television sets, I think the incidence rate in women in Korea of thyroid cancer has gone up 100 times in the past 10 years. And in this country, national registers would say that since the mid-70s, I think we have been progressively increasing the discovery rate of thyroid cancer, yet some, like myself, would say we haven't improved the mortality rate, which is minimal, and the recurrence rate has hardly changed during the 30 years we're finding these tiny cancers.
So we're finding them, but that's not necessarily a good thing. We're not actually saving more lives because you're finding more cancers.
Well, I think some folks have suggested that if we actually discover the tsunami of nodules in this country, and if we actually discover the 10% who have microscopic cancer that we don't know existed until recently, then some have suggested that the cost of doing the biopsy and just doing the surgery would be enough to cripple the American health system about 5 years. So
what you're saying is that a lot of these are small. They won't be growing that fast, and they won't ever cause a problem. Won't ever certainly take your life.
I mean, here in our own town, when pathologists had more time at their hands, a classic study done from Rochester, Minnesota, revealed that of 1,000 people dying in Olmsted County, more than 50% had nodules, and at that time about 5% had cancer, the vast majority of which was never discovered in life.
And why are you picking them up now? Because someone is ordering what kind of test? How are you picking these up?
Even sometimes orthopedic people.
Oh, no, we wouldn't know how to order
them. In other words,
ultrasound.
If one had a sore neck, often one ends up with an MRI of the spine these days. Often a CAT scan of the chest will demonstrate the thyroid. A variety of images of the carotid, the chest, the neck will incidentally discover nodules in the thyroid, and that leads to a cascade of rather expensive tests sometimes.
So basically, a lot of the time, these nodules are picked up on an examination that was done for another reason.
For a much more legitimate reason.
Yeah.
Okay. Or possibly doctors are more keen to look at a thyroid for a patient that's experiencing whatever the problem might be. And then if there's something already there, that's when they would find it.
That comes into it too. In other words, sometimes the symptoms of thyroid disease can be subtle. Often thyroid function tests can be borderline, and there is a tendency for doctors sometimes to reach out to imaging, which in this day and age would be ultrasound. And sadly, we now have the capability of visualizing a nodule that might be 1 by 1 by 2 millimeters, even smaller than a needle to biopsy it. So I think technology at the level of imaging has gone beyond what's really necessary.
So the technology has allowed us to find more of these nodules that may or may not be cancerous. But on the flip side of things then, the term watchful waiting has come into vogue, I think. Explain a little bit about what watchful waiting means to this process then.
Well, to put it in the big picture, if you took 100 people who have nodules in middle America in the thyroid, probably only 3 to 5% will prove to have a worrisome or malignant lesion. The vast majority can be confidently diagnosed with the biopsy, told that it's benign, and left well alone. Like many of these algorithms in medicine, however, there's always a sort of gray area where people are suspicious, and there's a lot of money being expended right now trying to use molecular genetics to discover whether the gray ones are really white and black. But in general, 85% of people can be put into the benign category. Less than 5% would end up with a must operate for cancer, and the middle section is becoming less of an issue as time has gone on.
Is more thyroid medication being prescribed because of it?
I think the sophistication of modern-day testing is such that I think a lot of people, doctors, are rather trigger-happy to start, you know, lifelong therapy for a minuscule minor aberration of thyroid function tests.
Yeah, can you explain to us, I want to go back just a little bit, and I tried to allude to this, what really the thyroid gland does, and isn't it interesting that you can easily live without your thyroid gland?
Sure. I think I've sometimes said to people that the thyroid might be deemed to be the accelerator pedal of the human body, and clearly one can usually get by at a slower speed. No one in this day and age dies of thyroid deficiency. And I think what has been a contribution from locally, we crystallized thyroxine on 1915 Christmas Day here in Rochester. And I think it's cheap, it's effective, and I think it's the main thing that the thyroid does, thyroxine.
The thyroxine was synthesized right here in Rochester.
Just before steroids.
Really? Christmas Day when?
1915.
Okay, so that's the replacement drug that you use if you have to have your thyroid removed for whatever
Absolutely.
Reason. Been around forever.
Well, It's been around forever. If you went to the abattoir and took an animal thyroid and chopped it up and sold it as desiccated thyroid, but that was the way of treating it until the Mayo brothers brought Ernest Kendall to town.
1915. Wow. That's something I'd never heard that before.
Well, you know, it's a good thing you're here. Think how much you've learned.
Keep listening.
All right. Wait, do we have time for a myth or matter of fact?
Well, I hope so. I wondered about thyroid medication because, as you said, you know, there's this watchful waiting. There's more people are learning about thyroid and possible problems. But once you start thyroid medication, myth or matter of fact, do you need to stay on it forever?
Well, I think if you're properly diagnosed with modern day testing, I think, and you've got a permanent deficiency of thyroid function, you need to stick with it for life. It's not going to recover. But I think in former years, when tests were more primitive, a lot of people were empirically placed on thyroid, and it's often an easy habit for doctors to just continue what the patient was on. But I think if someone's inappropriately treated with thyroid hormone, even if they've been on it for years, if the doctor's convinced that they don't really need it, you could actually stop it, and 6 or 8 weeks later, the thyroid will recover even after being put to sleep for years.
Should everyone have thyroid function tests as part of a routine examination?
There was a little bit of controversy when Mr. Bush got his overactive thyroid, and it was deemed that the first man in the nation didn't need a TSH test. And lots of questions were asked. But I think most internists, I think, in this day and age would screen patients with a TSH fairly regularly.
And that's called thyroid-stimulating hormone, and that
exactly.
will indicate whether or not there might be a problem with
overactive
thyroid. That
would be the first test to do because it's the thermostat of the system.
And it's relatively cheap, right?
Absolutely.
All right, you're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest and expert on the thyroid gland, Dr. Ian Hay. Coming up, this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams, and right after that, we'll be taking your phone calls, 507-282-1234. Your comments and questions from our website, radio.mayoclinic.org.
And the tweets are already flying in, as they do. Hashtag, yeah, that's right, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's another reason to get more omega-3 fatty acids, especially DHA, in your diet. A study shows these compounds may do more good for your body than previously thought, including preventing fatty liver disease. The researchers from Oregon State University looked at how omega-3 fatty acids affect the liver. They also looked at challenges the liver faces as a result of the Western diet. The results were surprising, the researchers say. DHA partially or totally prevented metabolic damage sometimes linked to the Western diet, meaning when people eat lots of red meat, sugar, saturated fat, and processed grains. Now, you can get DHA from supplements or by eating fish such as salmon, mackerel, or sardines. They say their study suggests DHA may also be beneficial for people with diabetes. This was published in the journal PLOS ONE. And in other news, a study from Mayo Clinic shows that the probability of blindness from glaucoma 20 years after diagnosis has dropped by half in the last generation. The findings appear online in the journal Ophthalmology. Here's Dr. Arthur Sitt.
We did find that, you know, dropped by nearly half the probability of going blind within 20 years of diagnosis of glaucoma. And then we also found that the population incidence, so you know the number of people in the population who actually go blind from glaucoma, also decreased during that time frame.
Dr. Sitt says this is a testament to the skill and effort of the researchers, physicians, and other care providers working in eye care over that period. But he says still, some people do go blind from glaucoma, and more work needs to be done to prevent and stop that from happening. And there just doesn't seem to be an end to the benefits of exercise. A study from Loyola University Chicago Stritch School of Medicine shows physical activity significantly extends the lives of male cancer survivors. Those who burned more than 12,600 calories per week in physical activity were 48% less likely to die than those who burned fewer than 2,100 calories per week. Researchers say many cancer survivors are living longer thanks to earlier diagnoses and better treatment. So physical activity should be actively promoted to these people. Now, lots of research shows physical activity extends longevity for cancer-free people. Little has been done on the longevity for cancer patients. This study shows moving more helps cancer patients live longer. The study was published in the Journal of Physical Activity and Health. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know, on air, online, and now we're on iHeartRadio, which brings up a point. I bet there are a bunch of professional golfers out there now who are on the driving range. They're listening to their doctor, Dr. Ian Hay, on iHeartRadio between shots. So I know we have to talk about the thyroid, but I want to ask you, how is it that you became the doctor for so many big names on the PGA Tour? I know you have an intense interest in golf.
Well, I do, congenitally. what I would say is that any exotic patients I've ever seen in the sporting arena, almost none of them have thyroid disease. And I think, although there seems to be a moment in American Olympic history that some would have all short-distance, high-speed runners have hypothyroidism, see the Wall Street Journal, I think this is hocus-pocus. And I think most athletes I've dealt with came to me for common-sense reasons, for reassurance, rather than thyroid problems.
Right. So which that means you're a very good, personable doctor, not just a thyroid specialist. And congratulations. It's fun to see those people around the clinic, thanks to people like you. So I got to remind our audience, time for you to join our conversation. Our telephone lines are open. Question about the thyroid gland? We are at 507-282-1234 with a Mayo Clinic expert. Or you can contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or you can tweet us anytime, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
We are never going to get through all of these questions. I have never seen so many tweeted questions, but let's start with a couple of them. Dr. Hay, what would you recommend a TSH level should be for someone who has had thyroid cancer?
I think the key word there is the had. I think it has been the tradition since the 1960s to put a patient who has thyroid cancer history on more than the average amount of thyroid hormone. In modern day parlance, that means the TSH level, the thermostat, is set a little lower because the thyroid hormone is higher than average. I think increasingly, thyroid associations worldwide have come to the conclusion that perhaps that's unnecessary once a patient is maybe 3 to 5 years out. So I think as time has come along and we're cleverer, I think we're now probably backing off on thyroid hormone suppression and returning to more normal levels of TSH. So mainly we keep it subnormal around 0.1, but we sometimes allow it to drift into the lower part of the normal range as the patient is further away from the initial diagnosis.
Now explain it. The TSH, that's thyroid stimulating hormone, and you get that test because you hope that it's normal. If you have more TSH than you should have, out of the normal range, above the normal range, that suggests that your thyroid isn't working very well and that your body is producing more TSH to try and stimulate it, right?
Well, I think it's a bit of, it sounds a little bit contrary. The TSH is derived from the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland controls other endocrine glands, and it's an early warning signal. So if the TSH is rising, the assumption is that thyroid is failing, and if the TSH is low, there's an assumption the thyroid is becoming autonomous or independent and working in an overactive way. Sadly, the reason why at Mayo, for example, we use a thyroid cascade is TSH is probably the best single test, but it's an imperfect test, and in order to know the true function of someone, you need to know both sides of the coin, both what the thermostat is telling us and what the thyroid is putting out.
When you say a cascade, you mean more blood tests than just the TSH?
In other words, we would send for a TSH. If it was abnormal, they would immediately give us a free T4.
Okay.
That's Deb's question that she tweeted in. Do I need every aspect of my thyroid function tested, and what should be checked on the lab sheet for blood work?
Well, sadly, I think particularly in private practice, there's a tendency to fill the whole page with T words. And I think fortunately, the more you know, the simpler it becomes. That I think TSH, free T4, and a T3 probably encompass all most endocrinologists in the world would want to know about thyroid function.
And the T3 and the T4 are both hormones that are secreted by the thyroid gland.
The ones that you couldn't pronounce, Tom.
That's right.
Triiodothyronine and triiodothyronine.
All right, 507-282-1234 is our telephone number. Thyroid expert, Dr. Ian Hay.
We have a question about juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Does a history of that as a child, obviously, affect your thyroid as an adult?
I don't think there's any direct causation, but I suspect that if juvenile rheumatoid or stool disease is assumed to be an autoimmune type of disease, then clearly patients with a rheumatic condition that's of immune origin are more prone to common things like Hashimoto's disease, and therefore a young woman with stools might be more prone to develop Hashimoto's disease, being the commonest cause of thyroid dysfunction in women in America.
A lot of our tweets have got Hashimoto's tagged on there, so explain, is that the biggest... most splash in the world of thyroid is Hashimoto's disease, and what does that mean exactly?
Probably 50 years ago it was all the rage, top of the pops. But
if it's got its own Twitter hashtag, it must be big.
Well, to put it in perspective, the thyroid, like any other organ, can be inflamed, and that's thyroiditis. Thyroiditis can be acute, subacute, or chronic. When it's long-term, it's chronic, and classically that's an autoimmune disease, and typically worldwide it's been called Hashimoto's disease. Dropping the Hashimoto, it's simply chronic inflammation of the thyroid, and in this part of the world probably affects maybe 3% of the population in the city, but probably about 30% of women, about a third of women, have antibodies congenitally, which they inherit from their mother. Mm. And the real mystery is, why does one carry antibodies in the blood lifelong and wait in the Bush family until you get to the White House to suddenly go berserk and become Graves' disease? So I think you have antibodies, and that's one part of the equation. As I say, many more people have it than develop the disease, and those women, particularly in some men who develop Hashimoto's disease, the worst thing that could happen to them is they develop an underactive thyroid, which is entirely fixable.
And that's the hypothyroid,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
507-282-1234. Let's go over to Helen. Good morning, Helen. Go right ahead with your question.
Good morning. I was wondering if there are any risk factors for thyroid cancer or other thyroid disorders?
Well, I think probably in the upcoming 10 years, probably we're going to know a lot more about genetic predisposition and changes in the genome. But classically, from the 60s to the present, I think we've always said the only known causation has been exposure to ionized radiation. And clearly, in former days, many young people were treated for acne, tonsillitis, thymic enlargement, and so on with X-ray treatments. And childhood irradiation or Hodgkin's treatment, for example, could lead to consequence down the road in terms of not only inflammation of the thyroid, but occasionally nodule formation, even thyroid cancer. So I think at the moment, if you took 100 people with the most common type of thyroid cancer, the majority, we don't know the causation. However, there are other types of unusual thyroid cancer, like medullary thyroid cancer, which tend to run in families, but that's a true rarity.
Thanks for calling in, Helen.
Very good. Thanks.
All right. And let's go over to Bob. Good morning, Bob. Welcome to the program. Go right ahead with your question.
Yeah, good morning, Tracy. Doctor, I've had a low thyroid for about 30 years. I've been on medication. Well, now my 22-year-old daughter has developed overactive thyroid. Are they related? And also, she's put on weight, which I thought was from a low thyroid.
Good question, but I think we know which part of our parents to blame for this. I think you also could probably blame your mother, your grandmother, because most men who develop an under or overactive thyroid have a female predecessor who passed on the genetics. But as I was suggesting earlier, classically, Hashimoto's disease is hypo and Graves' disease is hyper. But sometimes in the same family, if you had a number of daughters, you might have two with hypo and one with hyper. And I think they are related. In terms of your second question about perhaps the old myth about weight, I think a prominent colleague in Mass General used to have in his waiting room, I think, but probably now banned by the authorities, a notice that said, "No, madam, the thyroid is not to blame for your weight gain." I think for sure, when I said it's an accelerator pedal, it's certainly an enhancing way to improve your metabolism, and certainly has been used and abused by athletes throughout the years as a sort of pseudo speed. But there's no doubt that the vast majority of patients who have an underactive thyroid don't necessarily gain huge amounts. I think clearly development of an underactive thyroid can lead to weight gain, but it's not usually significant or massive or long-term.
But overactive wouldn't lead. Okay.
Thanks, Bob.
You bet. Bye-bye.
All right. Glad you called.
I have a myth or matter of fact question for you. My thyroid tests are normal, but I'm still tired, sluggish, and have dry skin. It must be my thyroid. Is that a myth or a fact?
I think it's a myth.
So it doesn't, these symptoms, the weight loss, the weight gain, the tired, lethargic, dry skin, do those things work in hard and fast lines for hypo or hyper?
Well, the symptoms you describe are clearly fairly nonspecific and sometimes can be part and parcel of thyroid presentation. But I think if you took 10 such people, I think maybe 1.5 of them might prove to eventually have thyroid disease.
And if that was the case, you know, it would be some simple screening test that would tell you for sure whether or not your thyroid was the culprit.
Can we talk about ablation? Because I think this is one of the most interesting things that in our dialogue of getting this set up that you mentioned. So explain alcohol ablation in relation to thyroids.
Well, it takes a Scotsman to be crazy enough to use alcohol to treat thyroid cancer. But fortunately, we took a page out of the liver cancer doctors. And for 21 years here at Mayo, and perhaps uniquely, we have managed to find an effective treatment that is cheap, relatively painless, outpatient, and costs about $40,000 less than a night in a hospital with a surgeon. And what I'm alluding to is that papillary thyroid cancer is the commonest type of malignancy of the thyroid, the one that is increasing fast in every country of the civilized world. When it recurs usually in lymph nodes, and many a patient has had many operations to remove lymph nodes, and radioactive iodine in the past was used to ineffectively treat them. What we've decided to do here in circumstances where the patient has had enough of conventional wisdom or radioactive iodine surgery is to inject under ultrasound guidance almost bubble amounts, micro amounts of alcohol into tiny lymph nodes and then admire the work of our radiologic colleagues in 3 months and see the cancer virtually disappear and die. And in 21 years, I think I've treated about 185 patients and we've never gone back in to reoperate on a lymph node that we successfully treated.
What
has happened?
It's been
a big success.
Yeah, what is happening when you do that? What does the alcohol do?
Well, rather like other parts of the body, if you stick a sort of toxic substance in, alcohol. Don't bring Dick Richard Firth back. Anyway, suffice it to say, it destroys the blood vessel supply and it shrinks and dies.
That's amazing.
Yeah. You know, alcohol can do the same thing if you take a little too much of it orally.
Hashtag Mayo Clinic. I should say hashtag thyroid. And we're getting all sorts of questions. You can send yours in. Jana said, I've been taking over 200 milligrams of levothyroxine for over a year, and I'm dealing with a lot of hair loss. Any suggestions? Is hair loss common in this case?
It could be, and I think 200 micrograms is usually enough for Tom Shives and yourself.
Yeah,
so I think it sounds rather a lot, and perhaps some careful retesting of the thyroid function might be indicated here. It sounds as if it could be related and a reduction might be necessary.
So that's a pretty hefty dose she's taking.
It is.
Yeah. Okay. What would be a normal dose?
I mean, we're unique in this country in having 14 different doses, but it goes from 25 to 300. But if the river's a 70-kilogram person out there, 112 would be the expected dose. So most people are taking between 100 and 150.
Okay. So 200 might be...
That's usually what you expect for a linebacker or a person being treated aggressively for thyroid cancer.
That much might make your hair fall out.
And many other things.
Again, some people are asking about the blood tests. What are the important blood tests that people should ask for if they want to start investigating their thyroid?
In Britain, they used to have a program called Desert Island Disc, but in Desert Island Endocrinology, if you're really stuck and only had two tests, the TSH and the free T4 would be plenty, and they're remarkably cheap and remarkably precise.
You know, I wanted to go back for just a second. We were talking about thyroid nodules and how so many of them are being discovered now. A lot of false negatives, false positives, rather. You know, something's there, but it's completely benign and never going to cause a trouble. And you had talked about or mentioned the vomit syndrome. I thought was very interesting.
I think we can attribute it to a prominent radiologist living locally, a bit of a cynic, but VOMIT in his mind is victim of modern imaging technology. And I think rather akin to some rabbit diseases like myxomatosis, I used to call it incidental omatosis, because every day at the Mayo Clinic, every hour, we see patients who have incidental discovery of probably benign and unimportant tumors that are picked up on the basis of high-resolution scanning.
Yeah, a lot of people are victim of the vomit syndrome, huh?
I'm afraid so.
That's the hazard of technology.
What a great term.
Exactly.
Why are thyroid problems more prevalent in women?
It's been nice for my practice, but I've no idea. I mean, many a chapter has been written about why so, but really nobody realizes. There is no good explanation, but I think in any particular disease, whether it's inflammation or cancer, 60%, 70%, 80% of many of the common thyroid conditions are in women.
Myth or matter of fact, taking thyroid hormone can increase your risk for osteoporosis.
That's controversial. Somehow European women who probably walk more don't seem to have an issue, and the doctors can't prove that. I think, however, there's good evidence that an overactive thyroid, like Graves' disease, the endogenous type of overactive thyroid, could turn over your bony skeleton and in the right time of life cause you to thin bones. But it is extremely difficult, near impossible, I think, to give people enough tablet form of thyroxine and affect the bony skeleton to the point of osteoporosis. But it's certainly something that many of our primary practitioners worry about. I think it's perhaps a little needless.
And we had plenty of tweets about generic thyroid medicine. Is there a problem with substituting generic?
Well, since the large institution across the road seems to have made all the employees, including people in my house, take it, there's been no loss of quality of life in our house. And it's cheaper than, dare I say it, the popular, formerly very popular, Synthroid. I think the reality is, when I went to the US Pharmacopeia and the FDA in years past to talk about the quality and purity of these products, it all comes from Puerto Rican powder. And rather like NASCAR, whether it's badged as Ford, Toyota, or Chevrolet, it's the same damn thing. So I think levothyroxine generic is here to stay, and it's probably something we could probably save money on and safely.
And you're confident in it?
Absolutely.
Very good.
All right. So what percent of all the nodules that are being picked up are truly benign, that you don't have to worry about? And is it important to know that, or can you just watch?
Well, I think classically, I mean, since about 1980 locally, the year-by-year figures suggest that about 85% of the nodules we find are probably benign. I think we can confidently diagnose it with a biopsy in 80%. And the vast majority of these patients don't require much follow-up, but reassurance and neck palpation.
All right. You're still enjoying what you do. You've had a remarkable career at Mayo, and I presume you're going to keep doing it?
I hope to for at least 3 or 4 years. Most of my classmates seem to be playing golf and fishing, but I enjoy what I'm doing despite your weather.
Thank you, Dr. Hay.
Yeah, and pleasure to be here.
Thank you. When you do retire, your golf game will get even better. It's a real pleasure to have you here. All right, you're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Well, Tracy, January was Thyroid Awareness Month. And you know what February is?
I do, as a matter of fact.
What is it?
National Wise Health Consumer Month.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Well, you know, the health insurance and the healthcare world can be confusing, even overwhelming at times. And we could all benefit from learning ways that we can better use the healthcare services that are available to us and get the most out of our healthcare dollar. Everybody wants to do that, don't they?
Absolutely. Dr. Michael Grover is going to be joining us from the Mayo Clinic campus in Arizona. He works with the group that is the Choosing Wisely campaign, which we'll talk a little bit about that. And then Dr. Juan Brito Campagna is going to join us. And guess what he is studying? The overdiagnosis of thyroid issues.
Well,
Dr. Hay was very excited to hear that Dr. Campana is going to be joining us.
I tell you, he's got big shoes to
that's right.
fill, doesn't he?
That's right.
And, you know, we'll tell you also why and how to get appropriate health care screenings, choose your health care provider with care, and practice healthy living in your own life. Tips for being a wise health care consumer next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For information on the topics discussed on this program, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program, as well as previously aired episodes. And don't forget, iHeartRadio. You can listen to us there 24 hours a day, too. Go to mayoclinic.com if you have more questions, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers share their expertise for you.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich, our associate producer, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Rich Peterson. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCrae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.